colleagues to this, our final event for the term from the STEM Education Academic Group. Really delighted to see people turn up, and hope that you are going to enjoy the refreshments as well. But of course, the star of the show this time is Dr. Keith Tabor, our colleague, who will be celebrating the publication by Routledge of Students Thinking and Learning in Science, Perspectives on the Nature and Development of Learners' Ideas. And this book launch is also to mark the recent publication by Springer of Keith's other book, Modelling Learners and Learning in Science Education, Developing Representations of Concepts, Conceptual Structure and Conceptual Change to Inform Teaching and Research. So Keith is going to talk a little bit about the first book that I mentioned, which is The Student Thinking and Learning in Science. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Keith. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for coming along. I know it's a busy time for everybody, and I also know there's football on tonight, so I'm very glad to have any kind of audience at all. As you said, we're primarily going to talk about this book, which appears on the screen here, but I will be mentioning some other publications. And I've called the presentation Can Research Inform Classroom Practice? And I don't want there to be too much tension, so I'm going to suggest that I think it can, just in case anyone was in any doubt. So this particular book is intended primarily for people who are actually working in the classroom and people working closely with them. So this book's intended for teachers, teacher educators, trainee teachers, education students, and people in that kind of background. So welcome to the Faculty of Education, for those of you who don't know the faculty. And you mentioned about our event. This is the Science, Technology and Mathematics Education Academic Group. And if any of you don't usually know about our events and want to know about the kind of things we put on, if you let us have the email, send me your email later, I can put you on our list. So the idea of a book like this is that it is based on research, it is a scholarly book in that sense, but that it's not written purely for researchers and it's intended to be useful for classroom teachers. Of course, I'm the author, I'm selling the book to you, I'm telling you this is something that's intended to be useful, only time will tell whether classroom teachers do find this useful or not. You also mentioned in her introduction that there's another book, and in fact, actually I consider this to be part of a trilogy of books. As you know, many novelists write their trilogy. Well, this is kind of my trilogy on this theme. That book was, first book was published in 2009. This is the book that was published just at the very end of last year and to the book we're talking about today. So to my mind, these three books are actually related. And the first book was talking about an area of research in science education, an area that's sometimes referred to as constructivism, sometimes referred to as the alternative conceptions movement. It's an area of research that looks at children and young people, students learning and understanding about different aspects of science. And in the book, I tried to set out that this area of work could be considered a research program in the sense of the scientific research programs proposed by Lakatos, the philosopher of science. And I also spent quite a lot of time in the book defending this area of research from various people who tried to say it was misplaced or irrelevant or outdated or had various other criticisms. And also in the book, I suggested some of the ways we might move this program forward. The second book I mentioned here as part of this trilogy was published on the last day of last year, 2013, and is a book that was intended to make a small contribution to that area of research, which is looking at the nature of modelling learners and learning in science education, and looking at the way we talk about that and the way we actually think and represent children's ideas, children's understanding and so on. And the idea was to actually highlight the fact that in much of the research in this area, the language that's used in research papers is actually quite sloppy and doesn't really take into account the actual level of inference involved in saying anything about somebody else's thinking or knowledge or understanding or learning. This current book we're talking about primarily today is a book which is intended for a readership, as I say, mostly of teachers and student teachers and people working in teacher education. And it looks at the area of research I've just mentioned, of students thinking and learning in science, and tries to see how that research can inform classroom teaching. And there's a big issue, I think, in educational research, which is the extent to which it does actually have an impact in actual classrooms and schools and other places of learning. And we hear an awful lot about the fact that educational research should inform the classroom, should inform teaching, and the current government, as some of you will know, the current British government actually sponsored somebody to write a paper about how wouldn't it be a good idea if teachers were involved in research and there was more research involving classrooms and schools. Many of you may know that the current postgraduate certificate in education, which is the qualification taken by many people with degrees who want to become teachers, is in many universities, universities such as this, a master's level qualification, and therefore is a qualification which has to include information about research and experience of working at the forefront of research. And therefore, students who are trained to become teachers in a PGCE course are not only told about some of the research that's been done, but are supposedly actually given the tools to do the research themselves in their own classrooms. And certainly the PGCE here, we have quite a high premium on that, and we even publish a little online journal which highlights some of the work done by some of our own trainee teachers when they're in schools. However, some of you who know about the English system may also be aware that this strong rhetoric about research and schools and teachers as researchers goes alongside a system where there does seem to be a strong central steer on how teachers should do their job. So for those of you who know about the English system, you'll know that teaching as a profession has been a big issue, and that teachers in England and Wales did not have a professional body until relatively recently, when the government set one up for them. And then after a few years, the government decided it didn't want them to have that professional body anymore, so it closed it down again. That's not the way most people think about a profession working. The normal understanding of a profession is a self-organising body of people that certify their own members and discipline their own members and so on. We've also had no end of guidance from the UK government, not only on what to teach and when to teach it and in what sequence to teach it, but also in how to go about teaching it. Much of that has been guidance. It hasn't been required that teachers take it on board, but there's a very strong inspection system in this country where many teachers and their heads of department and their heads of school are taking the view, well, if Ofsted are expecting a three-part lesson, as was quite common at one time, believed that we should have a three-part lesson, we should do it that way. If the official guidance is that we should teach this topic in this way, that's probably what inspectors are going to expect to see. And if we're not doing it that way, they might want a very strong defence, a very strong justification. So some of these things do seem to rather work against this idea that we want research in education, we want teachers involved in research. Some of you may also know there's a strong movement at the moment in this country to try and shift initial teacher education outside of universities as much as possible and place it in schools. And again, there's a question there that if you actually want research to be informed or to inform teaching practice, then shouldn't the people preparing to be teachers be actually working in the places where that research is done and not only in schools? So at the moment, trainees here spend a third of their training year in the institution, the university, two-thirds in schools. They're exposed to lots of mentoring and guidance and examples of good practice, but they're also exposed within the faculty to a high amount of input on the research that's been done and what that research says, and a critical view on that research. Maybe schools can do that work just as well, but I think at the moment that's really not proven. And there's a question mark about why the government is trying to push teacher education out of universities. So there are some issues there, I think. And as far as research is concerned, there's also quite a strong push at the moment that research needs to have something called impact. And therefore, if we're doing research, we're not only being asked, what have you done? Where has it been published? Has anybody cited it? But has it actually had an influence on practice? And I think it's quite difficult in an area like education to sometimes see educational research impact. One thing, educational systems seem to be very slow to respond. I'm not suggesting that's necessarily a bad thing, but there tends to be quite a lot of inertia in a school system. So if teachers are used to doing things one way, just because some research says something different may be a good idea, doesn't mean it will get taken up immediately. And we all know, or I think many of us know, that when teachers are not convinced by some change they've been asked to bring in, they find ways to subvert it. They find ways to be seen to be following the letter of the guidance, but perhaps not entering into the spirit of it. That's maybe a good thing, because obviously we don't want the system changing continuously on very little evidence. I actually believe that, in my experience, having worked in education for quite a few years now, as a school teacher and a college teacher and now working in the university, that we have seen quite a lot of change in the classroom that has been influenced by research. But what doesn't happen is a university researcher doesn't publish a research paper, which then all the teachers in the country read and decide to change what they're doing. What happens is, over a long period of time, there's a subtle drip feed. Information from research papers enters things such as digests, enters the thinking of people doing teacher education, enters into professional development courses. Slowly, over a period of time, people come to understand a better way of doing things. Teachers share their experience, talk about their experience, sometimes write about their experience. And if something really does work over a period of time, we do tend to see this change. We can't necessarily identify that this change came about because Professor X in University Y wrote this paper. It just doesn't work that way. So we see a slow change that's a kind of systemic change, but with a lot of inertia in the system, which perhaps acts as a kind of guidance to stop things changing too quickly. So if when we talk about research impact, we're looking to expect that teachers say, I've changed the way I teach electromagnetism, and I've changed that because I read this paper here in International Journal of Science Education, then I don't think we're going to see very much of that kind of impact. We will see teachers slowly changing their practice, but they won't necessarily know that that's been indirectly influenced by particular research studies. And I think there are examples out there of things that become extremely influential in education, but actually only quite slowly. Some of you may have heard of this work by a gentleman called Vygotsky, who sadly was long dead before he realised how influential his work's become in large parts of the world. Many decades after he did his work, other people realised its significance, and anybody studying education in most parts of the world today will not only have heard of Vygotsky, but realise he's extremely influential. I think if Vygotsky's work had been judged for its impact on education in his lifetime, it would have been seen quite limiting, and actually probably decreasing, because Vygotsky very much went out of favour with the people running the Soviet system. So where he did have a position that was quite influential at one point, his influence was gradually taken away from him. If he could see how influential his work's been now, he'd be very impressed. But it wouldn't help him in the research assessments that the government's run every few years. So I think there's indirect processes at work. Work's published in research journals, and it gets taken up in initial teacher education, and that feeds into teaching. It gets taken up in professional development opportunities and materials, that feeds into teaching. It gets taken up by teachers doing research into their own practice to try and solve problems in their own classroom. It gets taken up when people write books about how to teach in particular subjects, and it gets taken up occasionally if people actually write books about these kind of ideas that are intended for teachers rather than just for other researchers. So that's certainly my aspiration here, is this is that kind of book. And a long time ago, I did actually do some real teaching. And of course, none of you will think that photograph was posed for the college publicity officer. So it's very hard to document this, and I think there's not a lot of examples out there of research being documented or research impact being documented because it works in this way. It's moderated and there's not a clear audit trail. I was very lucky some years ago in that I got signed up to work on a project. I was given free rein to work on the project effectively. I was given a year to work on a project, which was a research-based project designed to actually take the outcomes of research into a form that could be taken into school classrooms. And I was even more lucky that the organisation that sponsored this, the Royal Society of Chemistry, a few years later commissioned a report from the Open University to find out whether the materials it was preparing for schools actually had any kind of effect. And therefore, I actually saw a report that said, yes, these materials did have an influence, that teachers did read them, and it did change teachers' thinking, it changed teachers' practice, and apparently reckoned it changed the learning that went on. Now, I can't validate that, but it's very nice to have people say that kind of thing. I suspect a great deal of the educational research, not all of it, but a great deal of the educational research that is done does have effect for these kind of indirect means. But usually you don't get put into a project where you're trying to disseminate research findings and where somebody then does a follow-up to try and find out whether there's been any kind of influence. That particular project was a project where research was digested, written in a form that was suitable for classroom teachers, i.e. without a great deal of focus on methodology, without too much technical jargon, and explained in the context of actual classroom examples that people would be using. So in a sense, this is a kind of applied research, and through this, classroom material resources were developed that people did actually use in their classroom. That particular project was only possible because of the generous funding of the Royal Society of Chemistry, but there are many of these kind of projects that go on due to various educational charities. I mentioned a trilogy of books earlier. The first book was trying to set out the nature of the area of research that I've been referring to, where researchers try and find out how children understand topics, how children learn about topics, how they think about different kind of conceptual areas. There's a great deal of writing in this area. Often it's written by different people working in different countries. It's been written over many decades. They don't all use the same kind of language. So one of the things I was trying to do when I tried to find a summary of this work was to try and find out what the core ideas were. And I came down to seven basic premises that I suspect most people working in the field would quibble over the language and disagree with some of the ways I've termed it. But I think generally people would agree is what the research is about. And basically it says that if we actually understand the way children think about science, that can help us teach better. Because the way children learn is influenced by the way they're already thinking about their science. And often the way they're thinking about their science is quite different to the way scientists think about the science. So children have their own conceptions of heat and their own ideas of what evolution's about and their own ideas about the nature of the solar system and so on and so forth. There's a lot of research that says some of these ideas are very different to the scientific conceptions. Some of these ideas are very resistant to teaching. But actually, if we do take their ideas into account, we have a greater chance of being able to persuade them of the scientific models. In the second book in the trilogy, the book which came out at the end of last year, one of the things I was focusing on is the way a lot of the research talks about this area. And there are lots of statements, and I picked a few here, but you can find many of them. So in one paper it says, about one third of the pupils at the compulsory school have little understanding of chemical change. So there's a study where they're actually able to give a percentage, a rough estimate of how many people think in a certain way. Another one says, many people have striking misconceptions about the motion of objects in apparently simple circumstances. Many people. Another one says, students' conceptual understanding of photosynthesis and respiration in plants was measured. And this one I particularly like is talking about a researcher in America who pursued a structured approach to science instruction that made students' thinking visible and therefore accessible to her observation. Now that sounds very, very impressive. Because in all my years of being involved in teaching at different levels, I have never been able to make students' thinking directly visible. And I think it will be so much easier for teachers if we were able to do that. If we could just simply look at a student and say, ah, I see exactly what you're thinking. Of course, that doesn't really happen. What we do is we draw inferences on the way people are thinking based on the indirect evidence of the way they represent their ideas when they talk and they write and they draw, or they dance, or they make models, or whatever. So those kind of knowledge claims, I think, are slightly questionable. What we would like to do in our research is observe teaching and know exactly what's going on. Teaching, I think, is an intentional activity designed to bring about learning. And we'd like to watch classrooms and see what the teacher's doing and know exactly what's in their mind. And then we'd like to actually see the learning that's going on and the learning representing some kind of change in the thinking of students, thinking that influences the learning and is influenced by the learning. These are the kind of things we'd like to do our research on. But actually, the observational data we get is utterances, gestures, things written on pieces of paper, and so on. So all of this is indirect evidence of people's thinking. This is pretty obvious. Unfortunately, when people are doing research in this area, after a while, they forget the fact that they're not dealing with people's thinking, they're dealing with indirect signs of it. And so we get this very sloppy writing. And they sometimes they get to problematise just how difficult it is to actually be able to produce a model of somebody else's thinking. And I think part of the problem here is something that the psychologists call theory of mind, which I'm sure some of you have come across, which is young children develop a theory of mind at the point when they start to realise that some of the other regularities in their environment are like them in having a mental life. So mummy is like me, daddy's like me, maybe the doggy's like me, maybe my teddy bear's like me. These things know, they think, they feel. Whereas the cupboard doesn't, my dummy doesn't, and so on. And that's something that's very essential in all of our development. To some extent, people on the autistic spectrum perhaps don't have normal development in that area. Unfortunately, what comes from this is by the time we become teenagers and adults, we tend to realise that we're quite good at mind reading, and we tend to forget actually we're not perfect at mind reading, that we can't automatically read other people's thoughts from what they say and the look on their face and so on. And in research, of course, we need to be a little bit careful what we say when we claim to know what somebody else is knowing or thinking or remembering or whatever. And here's a very simple diagram just to represent this. This box here represents a learner, who I've called Lev. And this represents something going on in Lev's mind. This is a researcher, Roz. And Roz wants to know what's going on in Lev's mind and wants to be able to report that in a research paper. So the only way Roz finds out what's going on in Lev's mind is by Roz talking to Lev or asking Lev to write something or to dance or to make a model. And Lev, if we're lucky, if Lev wants to cooperate with us, and if Lev has the literacy levels to do so, might produce some kind of representation that's visible to other people. Like he might write an essay, or he might draw a picture, or he might have a conversation, say something. That then has to be interpreted by the researcher to try and make sense of it and understand it. And so the researcher builds up a mental model of what's going on in the other person's head. And then they have to find a way of representing that. So that when they write about it, other people reading it will understand their mental model of what they think is going on in the learner's head. So that's the kind of indirect research we're doing in this area. Despite those difficulties, we still hold to this idea that it's possible to teach science more effectively if account is taken of the learner's existing ideas. And clearly we think similar things in maths and many other areas of the curriculum too. That the better, I'm looking at Libby, Libby's nodding. If we have a good understanding of what the learner's thinking, we can actually hone our teaching accordingly. We also think from our research that often there are strong commonalities in the way different students think about the same topic. So one particular example is force and motion. It is very, very common for people to intuitively feel that an object will only continue moving if there is some force continued to act upon it. That if an object is moving along and we don't apply a force to it, then it will come to a halt. We can understand why people might think that, because actually in practice, that's what happens in most situations. If you throw something or kick something or push something, it goes so far it soon stops. If your car engine stops, the car doesn't get much further. But of course, from a physics perspective, we know that actually, according to Newton, something will carry on moving forever in the same speed, in the same direction, unless a force acts upon it. But that's not obvious, because we can't always notice those resisting forces. So some things like that we know are very, very common. And because we know they're very common, we can design strategies that teachers can use to try and work with what children know and develop it in particular ways. And the work I did with the Royal Society of Chemistry, part of what we did was produce a lot of classroom activities based on some of the common ideas that children have that are incorrect from chemistry. Oh, and there was a whole range of them, the things we looked at there. The other side of this is that children's ideas are often also idiosyncratic. If you spend any time talking to children about their ideas, you won't be surprised to find that often you come up, the same things come up again and again. But every now and again, a child will tell you something, or a young person will tell you something, where you thought, well, I've never heard that one before. And of course, it's much harder for researchers to help teachers with that, because we can't catalogue all those ideas, because they're unique to individuals. So that creates a challenge for how we're going to build on that. Now, the work I did for the Royal Society of Chemistry, I tried to help teachers develop a kind of mentality as a learning doctor. Somebody could diagnose the kind of things that could go wrong and then think about how they could do something about it. And the book I'm talking about today was intended to build upon that approach. And in the book, if you had a chance to look, and there were some copies around, which I hope will still be there at the end, it was using a lot of examples of things that children have actually told me from a range of projects, in particular a project where I, over a period of 5 years, went to visit one of the local schools, and they very kindly invited me in and arranged for children to come and talk to me at lunchtime and after school and about what they were doing in science. So I've got lots of actual examples in the book from real children talking about actual science they've been doing in school and outside of school. And quite a few of these examples are also referenced with longer extracts via the website. In the book, there are three main sections. The first one sets out the issue I've been talking about, the background ideas. The second one introduces a range of complementary perspectives that's useful, I think, for teachers to have, thinking about children's learning. And the third one talks about this particular approach to being a learning doctor, to try and diagnose students' thinking and what might be going wrong when they do develop misconceptions and so on. I've tried throughout the book to actually include as many examples of children's actual comments as I can to try and give teachers a feel that this is authentic. The kind of things that any classroom teacher will find children saying to them if they actually find the time to talk to the children. And that is quite difficult because I know from my own time in the classroom, you're very busy, you've got a busy lesson, 25, 30 kids, whatever. You've maybe then got to rush off to another lesson or playground duty or an after-school meeting. Finding the time to talk to children individually about their thinking can be quite tricky. If you can, however, it does pay dividends. So, number of perspectives, ideas that are innate, how we develop our intuitions about the world, such as the intuition that things will stop moving if we don't apply a force. The role of language, we know language has a very important role in learning. The influence of everyday beliefs, the fact that there are some ideas that are very common in society which don't fit scientific ideas, but nonetheless get passed on from people through just general chit-chat. And children's ideas about their own learning have an influence on their learning. So their metacognition, whether they're thinking about their own learning critically, I mean, certainly working with new A-level students, getting them to do a concept map of a major topic, and some of them saying, well, I've never thought about it this way before. I've never tried to link these ideas together. And I remember interviewing a sixth former who was doing physics, asking them about physics and what it was about and how the topics linked together. And they were saying, well, I've never really thought about how these topics link together. They're all about different things. Do they link together in some way? And so actually developing children's metacognitive thinking and also their ideas at epistemological level. I mean, that sounds a big word. But often in science, we're working with models and we forget to say to the learners, this is a model. It has limitations, has a useful range of application, but there's a point when we can't use it anymore and we maybe have to develop a more sophisticated model. So there's a range of different perspectives there, and the final one is about integrating and bringing different things together, how children integrate their ideas into bigger holes, and some do that more than others, and clearly older children do it more, and the importance of actually integrating the ideas for effective learning. And then building upon those different perspectives to actually offer a kind of model for how the teacher might think about their science teaching in the classroom, how they might think about being a diagnostic science teacher. So when children don't learn the things you hope they'd learn, which inevitably happens, you don't just say, well, that was a failure at teaching, but you try and think about it as a failure in the system whereby the teacher interacts with the child's existing knowledge and tries to move it on. And looking at what might have gone wrong as a bug in that system rather than being a fault of the learner or a fault of the teacher. That's not to say that sometimes teachers aren't at fault. Teachers make mistakes, get things wrong. Sometimes children aren't interested in learning, aren't paying attention. But the cases where the children come along and they want to learn, they're keen to learn, and the teacher's prepared well for the lesson, it can still go wrong, because when you've got 25 children, 30 children in front of you, they've all got unique understandings, all at different points. There's no way you can just give one presentation that works well for everybody, so you do need to do some diagnostic work on top of that. As a teacher, you can prepare so far, by knowing what the common misconceptions are, by having a good understanding of what most children this age understand about this, what the research says is difficult to learn. But the individuals in front of you are different from any other children that have ever been researched. So there's always going to be a bit of patching up needed. It's a very interactive system. And, I mean, this is just a little diagram here, which, if you think about, I mentioned Vygotsky earlier and his zone of proximal development. Vygotsky basically was saying that all of us, in learning a particular subject, have an area where we're comfortable, an area where we're skilled, an area where we can perform competently. And a long way away from that is an area where we can't really do anything yet, because we don't have any skills, even if we're given support. But the interesting bit is the bit in between, the zone of next development, where we can't yet do things alone without support, but with the right kind of guidance and support, we can start to achieve, because that's where we're going to build up our understanding and build up our skills. And of course, if you're a teacher standing in front of a class, every one of the children in front of you has a different zone of actual development, a different zone of what they're currently competent in and understand well and can do, and a different zone of proximal development, a different zone of things they're ready to start doing well with the right amount of support. So for a teacher, that's a very challenging thing to have in front of you, and yet teachers with the right skills can be very successful. So what do I conclude from that? I conclude I have a very good aspiration, that I hope this book will inform teaching, because it's been written and addressed to teachers and teacher educators and trainee teachers. I hope it will be supportive because it produces, it uses a range of examples from real students, and it discusses them in terms of a range of the different perspectives that are currently considered to be useful amongst researchers. And it tries to prevent a model of teaching as being dialogic. I see Neil's in the room, who's an expert in dialogic teaching, amongst others here. And something that's iterative and interactive. And in particular, something you don't get right first time when you're dealing with children who are complicated and science which is complicated. And if you can actually teach a difficult science concept to a room of 30 people and they all get it first time, then probably you're teaching them something they already knew. Because actually it's not like that most of the time. So you don't give up, but you work on the fact that we've got so far, let's see where it's gone wrong, let's see what we work on. But what's gone wrong is to do with the complexity of the system. It's not necessarily a flaw in the student or flaw in the teacher. So I hope this book will contribute to research-based practice. I hope it will be. I hope some teachers will buy it. And if not, at least they'll go to a library and borrow it and have a look at it. And I hope actually some of them will say, that did give me some useful insights. But the aim is not just to say, here are some examples of things that children commonly get wrong, and this may be a useful way of thinking about those particular things, but also to try and help teachers develop that diagnostic approach where when things go wrong, you say, well, I've never read of a student saying that before and thinking that, but let's think about why they might be thinking that and what we might be able to do about it. So, we certainly believe as educational researchers we can influence the classroom, but it's a slow process, it's not always direct. So if we do want to develop a particular research programme, then yes, we need to make scholarly contributions to the research area itself, but we also need to think about how we then disseminate that in forms that are actually going to link to teachers and their thinking and be accessible to them. And that's what I had to say, and I hope there are some refreshments. And I hope you'll enjoy that. And if anyone has any questions or points, please do feel free to make them.